What if I told you that you could buy a fund that perfectly tracks the S&P 500, the market stays completely flat over the course of a week, and you still somehow lose a massive chunk of your money?
I mean, it sounds mathematically impossible, right? Or, you know, at least like some kind of Wall Street scam.
Exactly. But it actually happens every single day to retail investors who just don't read the fine print.
It really does. It's wild.
So we are going to unpack exactly how that happens, but first, just a really quick recommendation. This deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel.
Oh, yeah, they're great.
Right. If you are prepping for your exams, they have a full Series 65 course with, adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. It's a phenomenal resource, so definitely check it out at certfuel.com.
It really is like a total game changer for exam prep. And honestly, that ties directly into our mission today for this deep dive.
Yeah, totally. Because if you are listening to this, you are likely staring down the barrel of the Series 65 exam. And today, we are tearing apart the wild world of alternative investments.
Which, you know, on the surface might not seem like a massive priority to study.
Right. Because if you look at the grand scheme of the Series 65 syllabus, alternative investments, or alts, as they are known in the industry, they only make up about 2% of the exam.
Yeah, that translates to roughly what, two questions?
Exactly, just two questions. So the natural instinct for someone who is completely overwhelmed with studying is to just, skip this chapter entirely.
And that is a notoriously terrible idea. I mean, those two questions are the separators.
Just separators.
Yeah, they're the exact questions that the exam writers at FunRA use to determine if you actually understand the fundamental plumbing of the financial system or if you just, you know, memorized a glossary.
Right, they want to see if you actually get the concepts.
Exactly. The goal today is entirely about understanding the structural why behind these products. If you understand why Wall Street engineered these specific tools and how they actually function under the hood, you become completely immune to the convoluted trick scenarios they throw at you on test day.
We basically want to bulletproof your answers. And to do that, to make these highly abstract and sometimes downright bizarre financial products stick in your brain, we are going to use a recurring cast of characters today.
I love this approach. We are taking these dry textbook concepts and running them through the meat grinder of real, flawed, slightly ridiculous human
It
behavior.
really is the best way to learn, especially if, like me, dry lectures just put you right to sleep.
Totally. When you attach a dry rule to a funny narrative, you just bypass the rote memorization entirely.
So, listener, as we go through this, I want you to picture three specific people. First, we have Frank the Fidgety Founder. Right, Frank is that guy who is always starting like chaotic, capital-intensive, highly illiquid businesses. He has massive ideas, boundless energy, and absolutely no chill.
Sounds exhausting, honestly.
He really is. Second, we have Cautious Kathy. Now, Kathy is nearing retirement. She has worked her entire life to build her nest egg. She is terrified of market crashes, and her only goal is to protect her money so she can spoil her grandchildren.
A very common client profile, actually.
Absolutely. And third, we have Day Trading Dave. Dave operates with like five monitors on his desk, drinks copious amounts of energy drinks, and genuinely believes he can outsmart the global financial markets on a random Tuesday afternoon.
And most dangerously, Dave rarely reads the prospectus.
Never. He never reads the fine print. So that's a highly combustible mix of personalities for a very dramatic financial play.
It really is.
So I have to ask you directly, listener, take a second. Are you ready to beat the exam writers at their own game? Let's dive in. Let's start with our boy, Frank.
Okay, what is Frank up to now?
Well, Frank has a new obsession, and he needs a specific legal structure to make it happen. We are talking about limited partnerships, or LPs. Let's break down the foundational architecture here first.
Good idea.
What is the fundamental institutional logic behind why a limited partnership even exists in the first place?
So, to understand the limited partnership, you really have to understand the problem it was designed to solve. And that problem is taxes.
Of course it is.
Right. Specifically, the double taxation of traditional corporations. Let's say you start a massive business and you structure it as a standard C corp.
Okay, fairly standard stuff.
Right. But the corporation is viewed by the IRS as its own distinct legal person. So it makes $1 million in profit. The IRS steps in and taxes the corporation on that $1 million at the corporate tax rate.
Which, I mean, that makes sense. The business made money, so the business pays taxes.
True. But then the corporation decides to reward its shareholders by distributing the remaining profit as a dividend. So you receive a dividend check in the mail.
Nice. Free money.
Well, not quite. The IRS steps in again and they tax you, the individual, on that dividend income. So that exact same pool of profit has essentially been taxed twice.
Oh.
Yeah. Once at the corporate level and once at the individual level. Wealthy investors absolutely despise this.
I mean, I would too. So the limited partnership is like the loophole for this.
I wouldn't call it a loophole, really, but it is a distinct alternative business entity designed primarily for pass-through tax treatment.
Pass-through taxation. Okay, explain how that works.
Well, an LP is legally required to have at least two distinct types of partners with completely different roles and legal exposures. You have the general partner, the GP, and you have the limited partner, the LP.
Okay, GP and LP.
Right. And the absolute beauty of this structure is that the business itself, the partnership entity, pays zero income tax.
Wait, like none at all?
None. The entity is basically a ghost to the IRS when it comes to paying corporate taxes.
So where does the tax burden go?
Instead of the entity paying all the profits, the losses, the tax deductions, and the credits, they just flow straight through the business entity directly onto the personal tax returns of the partners.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, and this is usually done via a tax document called a Schedule K-1.
Okay, so it bypasses the corporate tax entirely, leaving only the individual tax. That is a massive, massive advantage.
Huge advantage.
Let's ground this with our characters to really make it stick. Frank the Fidgety Founder wants to start a massive, highly illiquid, incredibly noisy emu farm.
An emu farm? Of course he does.
Naturally. He's going to breed emus,
yeah.
Sell the eggs to high-end restaurants, maybe start an underground emu racing league. It's Frank, you know, so it's ambitious and totally chaotic.
I can picture it now.
Right. So Frank acts as the general partner. He is the one waking up at 5 a.m., buying the feed, physically building the fences, and, you know, wrangling giant angry birds. He is making every single day-to-day business decision.
He is the boots on the ground.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, Frank needs capital. So he approaches cautious Kathy. Kathy thinks, well, alternative milks are huge, maybe emu eggs or the next superfood, you know.
A bold thesis for Kathy.
Very bold. So she decides to invest $100,000 into Frank's farm. But she enters the agreement strictly as a limited partner.
Okay, this setup perfectly illustrates the core testable concept of liability. This is basically the beating heart of the LP structure.
Break it down for us.
So the general partner, Frank, assumes unlimited personal liability for the business.
I want to push on that word. What does unlimited actually mean when the rubber meets the road?
It means the legal wall that usually protects business owners, it just does not exist for Frank. Let's play out a fun scenario.
Oh, no.
Let's say Frank's fences are shoddy.
Oh.
A thunderstorm hits, the fences break, and a flock of 200 emus escapes. They stampede through the neighboring town, destroying cars, breaking storefront windows, and causing $3 million in property damage.
That is a nightmare. So the town forms a class action lawsuit and sues the farm, right?
Right. But let's say the farm only has, you know, $500,000 in its bank account.
Okay, so the business goes bankrupt.
Exactly. The business is totally bankrupt. But because Frank is the general partner, the town's lawyers don't stop at the farm's bank account. They come directly after Frank's personal assets.
Wait, really?
Yes. They can force the sale of his personal house. They can seize his personal car. They can empty his personal savings accounts. Frank is personally ruined because of the emus. That is what unlimited liability means.
That is absolutely terrifying. So why on earth would anyone ever agree to be a general partner?
It comes down to control and compensation. The GP gets to run the show, and they usually take a management fee plus a disproportionately large cut of the profits, but they bear all the risk.
Right. Okay. Now let's look at cautious Kathy. She is terrified of risk.
Which is exactly why she chose to be a limited partner.
Precisely. So explain her side of the equation.
The limited partner enjoys limited liability. Her risk is strictly capped by law to the exact dollar amount of her investment.
So she wrote a check for $100,000.
Right. And when the emus destroy the town and the farm goes bankrupt, Kathy loses her 100 grand and goes straight to zero. But that is where the bleeding stops.
So they can't take her house?
No, the town's lawyers cannot sue Kathy for her house, her retirement accounts, or her personal savings. Her liability is completely shielded.
Okay, listener, I have a direct question for you. Think critically about what we just discussed regarding Kathy's liability shield.
This is where they always try to trick you.
Let's say Kathy is sitting at home. She hears rumors that Frank's fences are shoddy, and she gets frustrated. She's worried about her investment, right?
Yeah.
So she drives down to the farm, marches into Frank's office, and says, move over.
Oh, boy.
She starts dictating the emu feeding schedules. She goes out to the yard and instructs the workers on exactly how to reinforce the fences. She gets on the phone and starts aggressively negotiating new contracts with the feed suppliers.
She is taking charge.
Here's the question for you. What happens to cautious Kathy's limited liability shield? Think about it for a second.
If you guess that she loses it, you are absolutely correct.
Boom. It just vanishes. Like instantly.
It completely evaporates. The legal protection of a limited partner is entirely contingent on them remaining passive. You are an investor. You are providing capital. You are not a manager.
Yeah.
The law, and more importantly for our purposes, the exam writers, they are very, very strict about this. If an LP steps over the line and begins actively participating in the day-to-day management or control of the business, they are legally reclassified as a general partner.
So if she manages the workers on Tuesday
mm-hmm.
and the emus escape on Wednesday, the town can now sue Kathy for her personal house right alongside Frank.
Exactly. She essentially pierced her own protective veil. Now, providing occasional advice or consulting with the GP is usually permissible in small doses, you know?
Right, like maybe a quarterly meeting or something.
Yeah, but actually binding the partnership to contracts or directing employees, that absolutely crosses the line. The rule you must remember is LP equals limited liability, but only if they stay out of the kitchen.
Or the emu pen, in this case.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
Now, let's circle back to that pass-through taxation feature, because I know there is a massive exam trap hiding in there.
Oh, there absolutely is. And it trips up a huge percentage of test takers, because honestly, it feels deeply unfair. It's called phantom income.
Phantom income. Okay, let's set the trap. Let's say the emu farm doesn't fail. In fact, year one is a massive, massive success.
Emu eggs are flying off the shelves.
Exactly. The farm generates a huge net profit. Based on Kathy's ownership percentage, her share of that partnership profit is exactly $20,000. She is thrilled.
As she should be.
But Frank, being the fidgety founder who controls all the decisions, looks at the cash and says, we aren't distributing a single dime to the partners. We are taking all this cash and reinvesting it immediately to buy 100 more emus.
Very typical Frank behavior.
Right. So Kathy receives zero actual dollars in her checking account. Here is the direct question for you, listener. Come tax time, does Kathy owe the IRS taxes on that $20,000? Take a second.
She absolutely does.
I have to push back on this on behalf of Kathy. How is that even possible? She didn't get any money. How can you be taxed on cash you never physically received?
I know, it's a tough pill to swallow, but it's because of the very nature of a pass-through entity. Remember, the partnership itself doesn't pay taxes.
Right, the ghost entity.
Exactly. The IRS requires the taxes to be paid in the year the income is earned by the entity. The IRS doesn't care what Frank decided to do with the physical cash.
Wow.
The partnership earned a profit. Kathy owns a percentage of the partnership. Therefore, Kathy earned a percentage of that profit. Period.
That is wild.
So she will receive a K-1 tax form in the mail showing $20,000 in taxable partnership income. She has to dig into her own personal pocket, take out her checkbook, and pay taxes to the IRS on money that Frank used to buy more birds.
It is absolutely brutal. And you can see exactly how a Fawn or Rock question will frame this. They will write a really sympathetic scenario.
Oh, they love a sob story.
Right. They will emphasize that the client received absolutely zero cash distributions, really hoping you take the bait and say, no taxes owed. But the IRS does not care about your cash flow. Phantom income is fully taxable.
Which is actually a perfect segue into suitability. Let's look at cautious Kathy's overall profile for a minute.
Okay, let's look at Kathy.
She is nearing retirement. She wants safety. She might need cash for medical expenses. Is this emu farm LP actually a suitable investment for her?
I mean, I would assume no, just based on the emus alone.
Well, forget the emus for a second. The structure itself is fundamentally unsuitable for her, primarily due to liquidity risk.
Liquidity risk meaning how fast she can get her cash out.
Exactly. When you buy a share of a public company, like, say, Apple, you can sell it 5 seconds later on an exchange. There is a massive, highly efficient secondary market.
Right. It's instant.
But when you buy into a limited partnership, there is generally zero secondary market. You cannot log into a brokerage app and just click sell on your emu farm shares. You are locked in.
For how long are we talking? Like a year?
It totally depends on the partnership agreement, but often 7 to 12 years. Sometimes longer, or until the underlying business project is completely dissolved and liquidated.
So if Kathy suddenly needs $50,000 in year 3 to pay for a grandson's college tuition, she is out of luck.
completely out of luck. Her money is functionally trapped in the business.
So, just to summarize the limited partnership before we move on, it is a real, tangible business entity designed to pass taxes straight through to the investors, avoiding that double taxation.
Correct.
But it requires the GP to take all the liability. The LP gets a liability shield, but only if they remain entirely passive. They can get hit with phantom income, paying taxes on cash they never receive. And crucially, they are highly illiquid, making them completely unsuitable for investors with short time horizons or liquidity needs.
That is the complete institutional logic of the LP. Nailed it.
Okay, so let's say Kathy realizes this. She says, I hate this. I don't want my money locked up for a decade. I don't want to worry about emus escaping. I want something I can trade on an exchange instantly, whenever I want.
She wants ultimate liquidity.
Exactly. But instead of buying an ETF that holds a piece of a real company, she accidentally buys something completely different. She buys a promise.
Yes. This is where we cross over into the world of exchange-traded notes, or ETNs.
I call this section the Billionaire's IOU. Let's break down the core concept here, because the name ETN is a deliberate psychological trap.
It is incredibly deceptive, honestly. When a retail investor hears the phrase exchange-traded, their brain has been trained by years of marketing to automatically fill in the word fund.
Right. They immediately think of ETFs, exchange-traded funds.
Exactly. But an ETN is a note. And in the world of finance, a note is debt.
Hold on. Let's pause there. If it's debt, like a bond, what exactly is the investor buying?
When you buy an ETN, you are buying a senior unsecured debt obligation, almost always issued by a major global investment bank. You are not buying equity. You do not own shares of a company.
So what do they hold?
And this is the most critical point. The ETN itself holds absolutely zero underlying assets. It is literally just a legal contract. It is a piece of paper where a bank promises to pay you a return that is mathematically linked to the performance of a specific market index when the note matures.
And when is that?
Which might be 10, 20, or even 30 years in the future.
I want to do a side-by-side comparison here because this is where the exam will really try to confuse you. Let's compare an ETF and an ETN that are both tracking the exact same thing, say the price of gold. If I buy a gold ETF, what am I fundamentally buying?
You are buying shares in a legally distinct fund, and that fund takes your money and physically goes out into the market and buys gold bars, and they store them in a vault in London or New York.
Or they buy futures, right?
Or at the very least, they are buying heavily collateralized gold futures contracts. The point is, the fund holds actual tangible assets.
It's like buying a basket of real fruit. You give them money, they buy the apples and oranges, put them in a basket, and you own a share of that basket. You can see it. It exists. Now, what if I buy a gold ETN from a major bank?
If you buy a gold ETN, you are simply handing your cash to the bank. The bank does not take your cash and buy gold.
What do they do with it?
They put your cash into their massive general corporate treasury to use however they want. In exchange, they write you a contract that basically says, in 20 years, whatever the published price of gold is on that exact day, we promise to hand you that amount of cash minus our annual fees.
So to use the analogy, it's like a billionaire writing on a cocktail napkin, in 10 years, I promise to give you the exact cash value of a fruit basket. There is no fruit. There's no basket. There is just the billionaire's promise on a napkin.
That is a fantastic, absurd analogy, but it perfectly describes the legal reality of the product. And this brings us directly to the biggest exam gotcha regarding ETNs, the fundamental trade-off between tracking error and credit risk.
Let's unpack tracking error first. What is it and why does it happen?
Tracking error is the frustrating phenomenon where an ETF fails to perfectly match the return of the index it's trying to follow. Let's say you buy an S&P 500 ETF. If the actual S&P 500 index goes up exactly 10% in a year, your ETF might only go up 9.85%.
Why the drag? Where did that 0.15% go?
It goes to the frictions of reality. The ETF has to pay management fees. It has to pay transaction costs to constantly buy and sell 500 different physical stocks as the index changes.
Right. Trading isn't free.
Exactly. It suffers from the bid-ask spread in the market. It might hold a little bit of cash that drags down performance. All of those real-world frictions create tracking error.
But ETNs don't have this problem, do they?
Not at all. And this is their primary selling point. Because the ETN doesn't hold physical assets, there is no buying and selling, no bid-ask spread, no cash drag.
It's just math.
Exactly. The bank just contractually promises to pay you the exact mathematical return of the index minus a stated fee. Therefore, an ETN has zero tracking error. If the index goes up 10%, the bank's math formula credits you exactly 10%.
Okay, listener, direct question time. Think about this critically. Zero tracking error sounds like a free lunch, right? The bank is guaranteeing perfect, frictionless index performance. So what is the catch? Why isn't every single index product on Earth structured as an ETN? Think about the billionaire's napkin.
The catch is the napkin. The catch is credit risk.
Explain how credit risk destroys the ETN.
Let's go back to the gold ETF, the real fruit basket.
Yeah.
If the mutual fund company that manages that ETF goes completely bankrupt, do you lose all your money?
I would assume no, right?
No, because the ETF is a separate legal entity, and the physical gold bars are still sitting safely in a vault. The underlying assets protect you. The fund is liquidated, the gold is sold, and you get your money back.
Okay, that makes sense.
But with an ETN, you own a billionaire's napkin. You own unsecured corporate debt. If that bank goes bankrupt, your napkin is completely worthless.
I can hear people saying, but it's tracking gold. Gold is fine.
And that is the tragedy of it. The reference index doesn't matter even a little bit if the entity promising to pay you doesn't have the money in their bank account. You could be tracking the most stable, profitable index in human history, but if the bank issuing the note defaults, you lose everything.
Everything, wow.
You are thrown into the back of the line in bankruptcy court alongside the people who supplied printer paper to the bank's offices. You are an unsecured creditor.
And this isn't just theoretical fear-mongering either. The exam writers absolutely love to test this concept using real financial history.
Yes. The ultimate case study, which you really must know, is the collapse of Lehman Brothers in 2008.
Right, the financial crisis.
Lehman Brothers was a massive, seemingly invincible global investment bank. They had issued highly popular ETNs, including some that tracked commodities and agricultural indexes.
Indexes that were probably doing just fine at the time.
Exactly. The underlying commodities were totally fine. But when Lehman Brothers famously declared bankruptcy, the investors holding those ETNs were utterly wiped out. They found out the hard way what unsecured debt truly meant.
So they thought they were just betting on crops or oil or whatever.
They thought they were taking on market risk, the risk of commodities going down. They didn't realize they'd actually taken on massive institutional credit risk.
So the golden rule for the exam, an ETN is trading tracking error for credit risk. You get perfect mathematical tracking, but you assume the total risk of the bank defaulting.
That's the trade-off.
And let me ask a clarifying question. If a major national bank issues this ETN, does that mean it's protected like a savings account?
Emphatically, no. This is another trap. ETNs are not FDIC insured. They are investment products subject to the full naked credit risk of the issuing institution.
Okay, so if they have this massive, looming Lehman-style credit risk, why on earth would Wall Street engineer them? And why would any sane investor buy an ETN instead of a much safer ETF?
That is the institutional logic question. And the answer usually comes down to two things: access to obscure markets and extreme tax efficiency.
Let's talk about the taxes, since that's highly testable.
With a traditional mutual fund or an ETF, the fund manager is constantly buying and selling the underlying assets. They're collecting dividends from stocks. They're collecting interest from bonds. By law, the fund is required to pass those taxable events on to the investor every single year.
That sounds complicated.
It can create a very messy, highly inefficient tax situation, especially in high turnover asset classes like commodities, currency swaps, or master limited partnerships. You might owe taxes every year, even if you didn't sell your shares.
But with an ETN, as we've established, there are no underlying assets being traded.
Exactly. Because it's just a mathematical promise, ETNs generally do not pay out periodic dividends or interest. The value simply accrues silently in the price of the note.
So how does the IRS treat that?
For tax purposes, the IRS usually says you only recognize a gain or a loss when you finally sell the ETN or when it finally matures decades later. If you buy it and hold it for over a year, you can usually get favorable long-term capital gains treatment on the entire return.
So for a highly sophisticated, wealthy, tax-sensitive investor who wants exposure to a really complicated, tax-heavy strategy, an ETN offers a beautifully clean tax wrapper.
Precisely. They are willing to stomach the credit risk of the bank in exchange for not dealing with a nightmare tax return every April. That is why they exist.
So to recap ETNs, they are senior unsecured bank debt. They hold zero underlying assets. They give you perfect zero tracking error, but they expose you to massive total credit risk.
Yeah.
And they are primarily used for access and tax efficiency.
Spot on.
Let's shift gears a bit. We just talked about ETNs, which are unsecured bank debt tracking an index, but Wall Street engineers are incredibly creative. What if a bank took that exact same concept, unsecured debt, and mashed it up with complex options contracts to try and sell a terrified retail investor a guarantee of safety?
Now you are entering the somewhat deceptive world of structured products.
I call this section the illusion of protection because the marketing on these is brilliant, but the reality is complicated.
Illusion is exactly the right word to focus on. Structured products are essentially hybrid securities. They are completely synthetic, pre-packaged investment strategies created in a laboratory by financial engineers to solve a specific psychological problem for investors.
Let's define the ingredients of this hybrid. What is actually inside a structured product?
Generally speaking, a structured product combines a traditional conservative security, almost always a zero coupon bond, with a highly volatile derivative component, usually a stock market option.
Let's bring cautious Kathy back to help us understand why this exists.
Oh, Kathy would love these.
She would. So Kathy is terrified of the stock market crashing. She remembers 2008. She remembers the dot-com bust. But she looks at what her local bank is paying on a standard certificate of deposit, and she knows inflation is quietly eating her purchasing power alive.
She is stuck between a rock and a hard place.
Exactly. She goes to a slick broker and says, "I am stuck. I need the upside of the stock market so my money grows, but I absolutely demand a guarantee that I will not lose my initial principal."
It is the most common request in wealth management. Everyone wants all the upside with zero downside, and historically, that was impossible.
But the broker has a solution.
Right. The broker's eyes will light up, and they will pitch her a specific type of structured product called a principal protected note or a PPN.
It sounds perfect for her. It has the word protected literally right in the name. It sounds incredibly safe. But I want to demand and explain, like I'm five, on how the financial wizardry actually works behind the scenes. What is the institutional logic and the math here?
It's actually a brilliant piece of mathematical engineering. Let's say Kathy agrees to invest $10,000 into a 10-year principal protected note linked to the S&P 500.
Okay, 10 grand, 10 years.
The bank takes her $10,000 and immediately splits it into two separate buckets. The first bucket is designed to provide the protection. The bank takes the vast majority of her money, let's say $8,000, and uses it to buy a zero coupon bond that matures in exactly 10 years.
Okay, pause. I need to explain. Like, I'm five on a zero coupon bond for anyone who isn't a fixed income expert. What makes it different from a regular bond?
Well, a standard bond pays you regular interest payments called coupons every 6 months. A zero coupon bond pays zero regular interest. Instead, you buy it at a steep discount to its final face value, and it slowly mathematically accretes in value over time until it hits its full par value at
Oh,
maturity.
I get it.
So in this case, the bank buys a zero coupon bond today for $8,000. Over 10 years, that bond is mathematically guaranteed, assuming the issuer doesn't default, to grow and be worth exactly $10,000.
Boom. There is Kathy's principal protection. In a decade, no matter what happens to the stock market, that underlying bond will have grown to replace her original $10,000 investment.
Exactly. The principal is mathematically secured by the bond.
Okay, but what about the upside she wanted? What happens to the other $2,000 from her initial investment?
The bank takes that remaining $2,000 and buys call options on the S&P 500 index.
And explain, like, I'm five on a call option, please.
A call option is a derivative contract that gives you the right, but not the obligation, to buy an asset at a specific price in the future. In simple terms, it's a leveraged bet that the market is going to go up.
So if the market goes up, the options print money.
Right. If the market skyrockets, call options become incredibly valuable. If the market crashes, the call options expire completely worthless and you lose whatever money you spent to buy them.
Okay, so let's fast forward 10 years and see how Kathy's hybrid product performs. Scenario one, the stock market has an agonizing decade and crashes by 40%.
In that scenario, the $2,000 worth of call options expire totally worthless. They go to zero.
But she doesn't lose everything, right?
No, because the zero coupon bond has quietly matured to $10,000. The bank hands Kathy a check for $10,000. She made zero profit over 10 years, but she didn't lose her principal. The protection worked.
Okay, scenario two. the stock market goes on a massive bull run.
The zero coupon bond still matures to $10,000. But now, those call options are deeply in the money. They might be worth $6,000. So the bank gives Kathy her $10,000 principal back, Pila US the $6,000 profit from the options. She gets $16,000 total.
Looking at those two scenarios, it sounds like an absolute win-win. Why isn't every retirement account in America stuffed with principal protected notes?
Because of the fine print, the hidden risks, and the exam traps.
Right. Okay, listener, here is your exam trap alert. I have another direct question for you. Take a second to think about this one. It says, principal protected, right on the glossy brochure. Kathy buys her 10-year PPN. But in year three, the market gets incredibly choppy. There is a recession on the news. Kathy panics, and she decides she wants to sell her note early and get her cash back. Does she get her $10,000 principal back?
The answer is an emphatic, painful no.
I am pushing back hard here. Why not? It says protected. It is literally in the title of the security.
Because the protection only applies if the note is held all the way to its final maturity date. Sure. You have to remember the mechanics we just discussed.
The two buckets.
Right. The protection isn't magic. It comes from a zero coupon bond that takes 10 years to mature. In year three, that bond has not matured yet. It is still heavily discounted. Furthermore, the options component might be bleeding value due to market volatility.
So what happens if she tries to sell?
If Kathy tries to sell in year three, she faces a massive problem. There is virtually no secondary market for these custom products. She usually has to sell it directly back to the issuing bank, and the bank will offer her whatever the current unmatured market value is.
Which could be terrible.
In year three of a bad market, they might only offer her $7,500.
So by panicking and selling early, she actually locked in a $2,500 loss on a principal protected product.
Exactly. The phrase you absolutely must memorize for the exam is, principal protection applies only if held to maturity. If you need liquidity and sell early, you are fully exposed to market losses.
That is a brilliant trap. But wait, there is a second trap lurking here, isn't there? The return of our old friend from the ETN section.
Yes. Credit risk. We have to ask, who is issuing this principal protected note, and what is the legal structure?
Let me guess. It's a bank, and it's unsecured debt.
You got it. Just like an ETN, a structured product is almost always issued as senior unsecured debt of the financial institution.
Oh, Kathy.
The guarantee of getting your principal back from that zero coupon bond is only as good as the bank's ability to actually write you the check 10 years from now.
So if Kathy buys a 10-year PPN from a massive bank, and 5 years later that bank suffers a catastrophic collapse and goes bankrupt, again, the Lehman Brothers scenario, what happens to her ironclad protection?
It evaporates into thin air. The protection was an illusion built entirely on the creditworthiness of a bank that no longer exists. She becomes an unsecured creditor fighting for pennies in bankruptcy court.
So principal protected does not mean risk-free. It means free from market risk at maturity. But it carries full unmitigated credit risk of the issuer the entire time.
Perfectly stated. And we have to mention one more silent killer for Kathy. Inflation risk.
Ah, yes.
Yeah.
Because 10 years is a long time to lock up your money.
Exactly. Let's go back to the scenario where the market crashes. Kathy locks up $10,000 for 10 years. The market stays flat or drops. 10 years later, she gets exactly $10,000 back. She feels relieved that she didn't lose money in the crash. But thanks to a decade of inflation, the actual purchasing power of that $10,000 is vastly diminished. It might only buy what $7,000 bought a decade ago? She survived the stock market, but she lost massively to the grocery store.
So looking at suitability, who are these products actually for?
Structured products are strictly buy and hold instruments. They are for highly risk-averse people who want some asymmetric market exposure, who absolutely do not need liquidity for a decade, and most importantly, who fully understand and accept the credit risk of the issuing bank and the inflation risk of the lockup period.
Okay, let's take a breath and shift gears dramatically. We just spent a lot of time talking about how Wall Street uses derivatives, specifically options, to engineer safety and play it safe over a long 10-year horizon.
Right, the slow and steady approach.
But derivatives are powerful tools. What happens when our third character, Day Trading Dave, gets his hands on derivatives? Dave doesn't want to play it safe for a decade. Dave wants to go absolutely wild, amplify his returns, and make a killing by 4 p.m. today.
Fasten your seatbelts, because we are entering the highly dangerous territory of leveraged funds.
I subtitle this section, The Daily Math Trap. This is where overconfident retail traders completely blow up their accounts. Let's start with the core institutional logic. What is a leveraged ETF trying to achieve?
A leveraged ETF seeks to deliver a multiplied return of an underlying benchmark index.
Oh.
Most commonly, you will see 2x or 3x leverage.
So give us an example.
So if the S&P 500 index goes up 1%, a 2x leveraged S&P 500 fund is mathematically designed to go up 2%.
Dave loves this. Dave thinks, why on earth would I settle for making 10% a year in a normal index fund when I can buy a 3x fund and make 30% a year?
Classic Dave logic.
Right. But there is one specific word in the prospectus and in the exam syllabus that destroys Dave's dreams of easy wealth. It is the most critical word in this entire section.
That word is daily.
Say it in for the people in the back.
Daily. These funds use complex derivatives, primarily total return swaps and futures contracts, and they use institutional borrowing to synthetically amplify their returns. But they are mathematically engineered to achieve that 2x or 3x objective on a single day basis only.
Single day only.
They completely reset their derivative exposure at the end of every single trading session.
I need to interrupt here. We are going to slow the pacing of this discussion down significantly. If you are listening to this on 1.5 speed while doing the dishes, I want you to slow it down to normal speed and focus.
Yeah, this is crucial.
To truly learn this concept, to not just recognize the rule, but understand it deeply enough to beat any convoluted trick question Fenneron throws at you, you must understand the underlying math of volatility decay.
Also known as compounding risk. This is the exact mathematical mechanism that systematically destroys long-term investors in these funds.
We are going to walk through the exact mathematical table that the exam writers use to test this. Let's trace day trading Dave's portfolio over just 2 days. I want to prove how this breaks down. Let's say the underlying S&P index is sitting at exactly 100 points. Dave takes his cash and buys a 2x leveraged ETF. He buys in at a price of exactly $100 per share.
Okay, let's establish the starting baseline. The index is at 100. Dave's 2X fund is at $100.
Day one happens. Dave has a fantastic day. The market rallies. The index goes on a run and goes up exactly 10%. So the index moves from 100 to 110. What happens to Dave's 2X fund at the closing bell?
It does exactly what it is contractually supposed to do. It delivers 2x the daily return. The index went up 10%, so Dave's fund goes up 20%.
Yeah.
So Dave's shares go from $100 to $120.
Dave is thrilled. He is popping champagne in his home office. He thinks he is a financial genius. But remember the key word, daily reset. Overnight, the fund recalculates its derivative swaps based on the new, larger asset base. When the market opens tomorrow, it is a brand new mathematical reality.
Right. Yesterday doesn't matter anymore.
So day two happens. The market gets spooked by an inflation report. The index drops exactly 9.09%.
Now let's clarify why we're using the very specific number of 9.09%. Because a 9.09% drop from the new index level of 110 brings the index exactly back down to 100.
Right. Okay, listener, direct question time. Think about the net result here. The index started yesterday at 100, it went up to 110, and today it fell back down to exactly 100. The index is completely flat over the two-day period. Its total return is 0%.
Yeah.
So what is the value of Dave's 2x leveraged fund? Take a beat and think it through.
The intuitive answer, the wrong answer that Dave relies on, is that because the index is flat, his fund should also be flat at his original $100 investment.
But it's not, is it?
Not at all. Let's do the brutal, unavoidable math of the daily reset. On day two, the index dropped 9.09%. The 2X fund must deliver exactly twice that daily drop. So 9.09% times two is an 18.18% drop.
Okay, and what is an 18.18% drop applied to Dave's day? One closing value of $120.
Well, if you take 18.1% of $120, that is $21.82.
Oh, man.
Right. Subtract that from 120, and it brings Dave's fund down to $98.18.
Boom. Dave lost money. The index started at 100 and ended at 100. The underlying market did absolutely nothing over 2 days.
Yeah.
Yet Dave lost 1.82% of his initial capital. How is this mathematically possible? What is the why behind this decay?
It is the mathematical reality of compounding percentage gains and losses from a constantly moving baseline. I like to use the analogy of digging a hole.
Let's hear it.
If you have $100 and you lose 50%, you are down to $50. You are in a deep hole. To get out of that hole and get back to your original $100, you don't need a 50% gain. You need a 100% gain. The math works against you on the way back up.
That makes a total sense.
With a daily reset leveraged fund, Dave was applying a massive 2x loss on day two, but he was applying it to a much larger number, that $120, than he started with. An 18% loss on 120 destroys much more capital than a 20% gain on 100 creates.
Wow.
Because the fund resets its target every single day, this compounding effect acts like a buzzsaw in choppy, volatile markets. The larger the daily swings, the deeper the hole it digs, systematically destroying value over time.
So volatility decay comes from the daily mathematical reset, not from the overall long-term direction of the index. Mm. The exam uses this exact flat market scenario to trick candidates who lazily assume index unchanged equals fund unchanged.
Exactly. FINRA is hyper aware of this mathematical trap. They know retail investors don't understand it, and they have issued explicit suitability guidance, specifically regulatory notice 09-31, regarding how brokers must handle these products.
What does the regulator actually say?
FINRA explicitly warns that leveraged ETFs are typically unsuitable for retail investors who plan to hold them for longer than one trading session. Read that again. Longer than one day. They state that these products are particularly toxic in volatile markets where the decay is accelerated.
So how does this translate to the exam? What is the suitability trap they will set for you?
The trap is always the phrase long-term investor. If an exam question describes a client looking for a long-term hedge or a buy-and-hold growth strategy, or someone seeking leveraged market exposure for their 401k retirement account, a leveraged ETF is never, under any circumstances, the correct answer.
Never ever. Like, there's no exception.
Never. These are highly specialized tools built for short-term, sophisticated day traders who want to place a highly tactical intraday bet. Dave can buy it at 10 a.m., ride a market trend, and sell it at 3 p.m. to close his position. That's fine. That is what it is designed for.
But if he holds it overnight?
Right. If Dave buys it, falls asleep at his desk, and holds it for a month while the market bounces around violently, his account will bleed out through volatility decay.
Okay, so leveraged funds multiply the market's direction, but they rot from the inside out if you hold them. But let's introduce a new scenario. What if Dave wakes up, reads a terrifying news headline about global supply chains, thinks the stock market is going to absolutely crash tomorrow, and wants to buy a fund that does the exact opposite of the market?
Now Dave is looking for an inverse fund.
I like to call these the treadmill to hell.
That is painfully accurate. Inverse ETFs, sometimes called short funds or bear funds, seek to deliver the opposite of the daily performance of an underlying index.
So the market goes down, these go up.
Right. If it's a standard inverse fund, it is seeking a negative 1x return. If the index falls 2%, the inverse fund should theoretically gain 2% that day.
And Wall Street engineers can combine this inverse function with leverage.
Oh, absolutely. You can have inverse leveraged funds, negative 2x or even negative 3x. They use derivatives, primarily total return swaps with large investment banks, to synthetically create this short exposure without actually having to go through the expensive, complex process of borrowing and shorting millions of physical shares of stock.
Okay, so if the market goes down, these funds go up. That sounds like a great way to hedge a portfolio. But wait, I have a suspicion. Do these inverse funds use the exact same daily reset mechanism we just talked about?
They absolutely do, and that is why your treadmill analogy is perfect. The inverse relationship, the guarantee to deliver the exact opposite return, applies only to the daily return. It does not apply to the weekly return, the monthly return, or the annual return.
It's just day by day.
Exactly. Every single night at the close of business, the fund recalibrates its massive derivative swap exposure to reset the baseline for the next day.
So if it's a treadmill that keeps speeding up and resetting your position every night, if I stay on that treadmill for a week in a volatile market, I'm going to end up in a completely different place than I expected.
Precisely. Inverse funds suffer from the exact same volatility decay and compounding risk as leveraged funds. Over longer holding periods, the actual returns of the fund will inevitably mathematically diverge from the expected inverse return of the index.
And the exam absolutely loves to test this divergence. because it is so counterintuitive.
Yeah.
The textbook has a staggering real-world example from the 2008 to 2009 financial crisis that perfectly illustrates this. Let's walk through this carefully because it breaks people's brains.
It really does. During a very highly volatile period in 2008, there was an underlying oil and gas index.
Okay.
Over a specific multi-month period, the index was wildly volatile. Up huge one day, down huge the next. But at the end of the period, the index had gained exactly 2% overall.
Okay, so the underlying index is up 2%. What happened to the standard 2x leveraged ETF tracking that index? It should be up 4%, right?
Wrong. The 2x leveraged ETF, which was mathematically supposed to amplify gains, actually fell by 6%.
Wow. The index went up 2%, but the 2x fund went down 6%. That is volatility decay in action. The violent chopping back and forth destroyed the capital base, even though the ultimate trend was slightly up.
Mm-hmm.
But wait, it gets crazier. What happened to the inverse 2x ETF, the one betting against the index?
The inverse 2x ETF fell a staggering 26%.
Okay, direct question time for the listener. Stop what you are doing and think about this logically. The index went up, so obviously the inverse fund betting against it should lose money. That makes sense. But why did the regular leverage bull fund also lose money? How can both the bull fund and the bear fund lose massively at the exact same time? Take a second.
It is because in choppy markets, volatility decay is entirely agnostic. It doesn't care which direction you are betting.
It just destroys everything.
Yep. The math of the daily reset and the compounding from a moving base will eat both sides alive simultaneously.
That is the ultimate exam gotcha. An inverse fund can and will lose money, even when the underlying index also declines over a multi-day period, if the path to get there was volatile enough. Both leveraged and inverse products will diverge dramatically from their expected multiples.
And because of this structural mathematical flaw, the suitability rules enforced by regulators for inverse funds are just as strict, if not stricter, than for regular leveraged funds.
Let's lay them out clearly. Who is an inverse fund actually suitable for?
They are for short-term tactical hedging by highly sophisticated traders, period. If day trading Dave sees a terrible earnings report scheduled for tomorrow morning, and he wants to hedge his portfolio for exactly 24 hours, he can use an inverse ETF. He buys it, he gets the short exposure for the day, and he sells it.
And who are they definitively not for? What is the trap?
The classic exam trap is a client exactly like Cautious Kathy coming into a broker's office and saying, I am terrified of a bear market. I want to permanently hedge my retirement portfolio against a long-term crash, put 10% of my money in an inverse ETF and just leave it there.
Which, to a layman who doesn't understand derivatives, sounds perfectly reasonable. It sounds like buying insurance.
It sounds reasonable, but financially and legally, it is malpractice. If you put Kathy in an inverse ETF for 5 years, the daily reset and compounding risk will mathematically grind that investment down towards zero, even if the broader market eventually goes through a crash somewhere in those 5 years.
The bus all gets her.
Yes. The path dependency destroys the long-term hedge. You never, ever put a buy and hold client into an inverse ETF.
Okay, we have covered a tremendous amount of structural ground today. We have gone from the pass-through taxation of emu farms to the unsecured credit risk of billionaires' napkins, to the illusion of protection with zero coupon bonds, to the mathematical buzzsaw of the daily reset.
We covered a lot of ground.
It is time for the synthesis. We have explained the why and the how. Now let's lock in the testable takeaway so you can execute on exam day. When our listener sits down at the testing center and a convoluted paragraph about alternative investments pops up on the screen, what is the internal checklist they need to run through?
You need to ask yourself 5 critical questions to dissect the institutional motives behind the scenario. Question 1. What is the primary structural risk of the product being described?
Okay, so give us the examples we used.
If the question is about Frank's limited partnership, Wall Street built that for tax reasons. So the primary trade-off risk is illiquidity. You are locked in and cannot sell it. If it is an ETN or a structured product, Wall Street built that using bank balance sheets. So the primary risk is issuer credit risk. The bank might default.
And what about Dave's funds?
If it is Dave's leveraged or inverse fund, Wall Street built that for daily hedging. So the primary risk over time is volatility decay from the daily reset.
Excellent. Question 2.
Question 2. Is it suitable for the client's time horizon? You have to match the product's lifespan to the client. LPs require a long-term, multi-year horizon because of the illiquidity. Leveraged and inverse funds are strictly for intraday or single session holding because of the math. Never mix those up.
Question 3.
Question 3. Is it a daily reset product? Look for the trigger words leveraged, inverse, or 2x, 3x. If it resets daily, absolutely no buy and hold strategies are permitted.
Question four.
Who bears the credit risk? Look for the phrase unsecured debt or debt note. That automatically means ETNs and structured products. It means the investor is relying entirely on the bank's survival, not on any underlying physical assets in a vault.
And question 5.
Question 5. What is the specific tax treatment? If it is an LP, think pass-through taxation via a Schedule K-1 and beware of the phantom income trap. If it is an ETN, think tax efficiency, usually treated as long-term capital gains at maturity or sale because there are no annual dividends.
Fantastic. Now I am going to rapid-fire the 3 absolute biggest exam traps one last time just to hammer them into your brain. Trap 1. A limited partner enjoys limited liability until they step over the line and start participating in management decisions. The second cautious Kathy tells Frank how to feed the emus. She pierces her own veil and becomes a general partner with unlimited personal liability.
That is a massively tested concept. Keep the LP out of the kitchen.
Trap 2. Principal-protected structured notes are only protected if you hold them all the way to their final maturity date 10 years from now. If you panic and sell in year 3, the zero-coupon bond hasn't matured and you can lose a massive chunk of your principal.
Selling early instantly breaks the protection.
And trap 3. Exchange-traded notes has zero tracking error because they are just a mathematical promise, which sounds great, but they carry full Lehman Brothers-style credit risk. An ETF has annoying tracking error, but zero credit risk because it holds actual physical assets in a vault.
It is the ultimate trade-off of tracking error versus credit risk. Know it cold.
Listener, I want to congratulate you. If you have followed us through this deep dive, you haven't just memorized a list of dry, arbitrary rules. You actually understand the institutional motives.
You know the why behind the what.
Exactly. You know why Wall Street uses zero coupon bonds to create an illusion of safety? You know how the daily reset mathematically digs a hole and destroys Dave's portfolio? You know why Frank has to take the liability to allow the tax pass through? Because you understand the why and the how, you are now fully immune to FinanRe's trick questions. They can wrap the concept in whatever confusing word problem they want, and you will see right through the matrix.
You have built a really solid structural foundation.
We like to end every deep dive with a final provocative thought. Something to chew on that builds on what we just learned, but takes it one step further.
Today, we spent a lot of time looking at how the math of daily resets and compounding essentially manufactures losses out of flat, choppy markets for leveraged and inverse funds. It is a destructive, unavoidable mathematical force. Volatility decay.
It's a buzzsaw.
Right. But it raises a fascinating structural puzzle for the future of finance. If Wall Street quants know for an absolute mathematical certainty that derivatives and compounding will destroy value through volatility decay over a long enough timeline, could they eventually use those exact same mathematical principles in reverse?
What do you mean by in reverse?
Well, could an engineer design an alternative fund structure that systematically harvests that volatility decay for a gain? Essentially, a fund that mathematically shorts the decay itself, generating a yield from the chaos, but doing so without taking on the massive unsecured credit risk of a bank ETN. It is something the smartest quants on Wall Street are constantly pondering as market structures evolve.
That is a wild thought, harnessing the buzzsaw to generate power instead of just being cut by it. I love it. Listener, thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep analyzing the why, trust the math, and go crush that exam. See you next time.